record. All right, let's start with Proverbs, shall we? Proverbs 24, verse 10. In light of our friend Joshua stepping up to the plate today at some point, around the 7 o'clock hour, we should meet him. This is a good one, all right? 24:10. All right, mine says, if you are slack in the day of distress, your strength is limited. What does that mean? What's the idea there? If you're slack in the day of distress, what type of day is that? It's a rough day, and you're needed to step up, right? If you're called to step up and lead or be prepared or whatever it may be, okay, and all your preparation, everything you've done up to that point is fantastic, but if you can't handle it in the day when it matters, your strength is limited. It doesn't matter. Okay, our old pastor back in Denton would say, looks like Tarzan and plays like Jane, that type of deal, right? You look really impressive on the outside, you know, an athlete's mentality. You can bench press a whole lot. You look really impressive. You prepared. But man, when Friday night comes and the lights are on you, you completely and utterly fail. Every time I think about this proverb, I think about that movie called The Program, early 90s football movie, bad. Anyway, there was a guy in there that kind of the subplots of the different players that were going on. And there was this guy that was just like a roid junkie, right? Steroids, huge, worked out. I mean, the whole deal. But when it came time to play, the guy looked really, really impressive on the outside. But he couldn't get it done on the field. So reminds me of that. We're about to see Joshua step into some really big shoes. Arguably, there's not a whole lot of bigger shoes to fill, okay? And he's got to step up to the plate, and he's got to lead in the day when it is scary. And the things that you're going to watch him do this morning, you're going to go, that is dumb. Like, to trust God to the degree that he does is insane. And God's going to honor what he does, okay? Teddy Roosevelt was asked during his presidency, in the midst of all that he had to deal with as a president, what did they ask him? How can you be so brave? And he said, I imitate brave men. I thought that was a great answer for a guy to say, listen, I hold the most important position in the United States and arguably the world, and I am scared to death, and I just imitate men that aren't, right? Leaders and cowards are, heroes and cowards are all the same, I've heard it said. They all deal with fear. Some succumb to it, and some just choose to fight through it, okay? But there is no such thing as a leader who does not experience fear. We all deal with it. We all have to embrace it, and the way that we respond to it determines how we're going to ultimately lead, okay? And if we are slack in the day of the stress, when we are called to step up and we feel that fear and we are crippled by it, that's the difference between someone that's going to step up and do great things and someone that's going to cower down to fear. Men stormed the beach of Normandy. They were told by their commander, there's two type of people on this beach, the ones that are dead and the ones that are gonna be. But wow, right? But they said, we've got to storm the castle, right? We've got to conquer the, whatever the beachfront was, okay? So just a good reminder to us. You guys will be impressed with Joshua. He is a phenomenal leader and a guy that's gotta fill, again, some pretty impressive shoes, okay? So reminder to all of us, if you're not dealing with fear, you're not stepping out in faith, okay? You should be at some points in your life, all right? And it's not the absence of fear that makes you a leader. It's the ability to deal with that fear and navigate your way through it and plow on regardless, all right? Thoughts on that? All right. Andy Stanley, by the way, has a great book on some nuggets of leadership, and that's one of them. And it's he talks about this idea of fear in a really cool way. So if you're an Andy Stanley fan, he does a great job with that one. All right. I can't remember. It's like five areas. It's a thin book. It's a good read. He hasn't written a ton of them. It's not the one on Nehemiah. Is that helpful, Evan? How about I tell you what it's not? All right, Evan, you unfearful one, pray for us, and then we will dive back into Deuteronomy. Amen. All right, Deuteronomy, give me a theme. Out loud.
Second law.
Second law or... Review, thank you, all right? Chapters 1 through 3 are the past, 4 through 11 present, all right? You guys know all this, 12 through 30, it's the book after Numbers. Okay, keep going. 12 through 30 is the law again, and then 31 through 34 is going to be Moses' swan song, his last words, and some prophecy, okay? So we saw yesterday, incredibly important section of Deuteronomy called the what? Chapter 6, the Shema. If you're from Texas, the Shema, whatever you want to call it, we're down with whatever, okay? The Shema, what does Shema mean in Hebrew? Hear, or listen, okay? Hear, O Israel. So hear is probably correct, okay? On that note, our friend Andrew will be giving you a quiz on Wednesday when he comes back in to lead worship in English and in Hebrew, okay? So, have it ready. Doesn't mean it has to be perfect, but, okay, you should know some words in Hebrew now, okay? At the very least, have the English down, all right? So start working on that so there's some timeline for you, okay? Andrew has a lot of harmonizers, so he's not going to beat you over the head with it, so, okay? But do some work on it, all right? Make sure that you're ready. Sorry, brain dysfunction. Shabbat is tonight at Rebecca Ashley's house. Last year's resident, she was here that morning when we cooked. So if you got, you're all invited. If you guys want to come, it's tonight. Okay, so, and there was one more thing I was going to tell you. Dang it. That note is right next to my desk where Jared's chart is. Three things. Got two of them. It's pretty good. 66%. So I will remember it at some point and then just blurt it out. So, all right. So, we are kind of midway through Deuteronomy. We finished in 9, I believe, yesterday, correct? Right? We got up into there, okay? So we won't cover a ton more in this section, okay? Again, this is Israel's present, a command to obey, right? The key to present victory for them was what? Obedience, right? Okay, so just keep that on the forefront of your mind. Joshua is going to carry that theme into the conquering of the land, all right? So he's going to get there, all right? So, for the most part, that kind of calls us up to where we are currently at, all right? Chapter 10 is a review of the Shema and some other things. I'm sorry, 11 is a review of the Shema. There is an interesting theme that we're seeing that we'll see even more on the backside of Deuteronomy. And we've talked about it before. Look at 11, verse 26, okay? And this is here's the Cliff Notes version of what God is ultimately going to tell him about obedience and disobedience, okay? 11, verse 26, read that.
See, I am setting before you today a blessing and a curse. The blessing if you obey the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you today, and the curse if you do not obey the commandments of the Lord your God, to turn aside from the way that I am commanding you today, to go after other gods that you have not known.
All right, so they have two options. You obey, and what happens? Blessing. You guys are going to get your socks blessed off, okay? You disobey, and it's going to be rough. You are going to get cursed, okay? So they have the option. Obey God, walk in a system, honor him, put him first, sin, repent, move on, okay? Work within the system, or go follow other gods, okay? Now, by the way, we know what's going to happen. God's going to tell Moses before they even go into the land, by the way, this people, they're not going to obey me. They're going to go after other gods. They're going to disobey. I'm going to have to kick them out of the land. He tells Moses all of this before they go on the land, okay? Fascinating that God has already predicted and seen all of the stuff that's going to happen, and yet he tells them, you have the opportunity. The choice is yours, okay? Verse 29 of chapter 11, Brad mentioned this on Sunday. Two mountains, Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, okay? Inside the land, they are going to stand on those mountains, and they're going to shout portions of Deuteronomy back to one another, okay? Do this and we get this if we obey. Do this and we get cursed if we disobey. Okay, so literally they're going to recite these things to one another on two different mountains as a reminder of what God has told them to do. All right? So that's the idea. So blessings and cursings, and that's going to get unpacked towards the end of Deuteronomy in great detail. We won't read all of it, but it's kind of like we've seen before. The blessings portion is short. The cursing portion is very long. So it's like, whew, obey. Okay, good idea. All right? So, chapter 12 begins the, again, reiteration of the law. So, most of these things we have all heard. I want to highlight a couple that'll be new to you, okay? As you guys looked at your chapter headings, I thought they did a great job in that chart. They walked through the Ten Commandments, the Deuteronomy chart that they put out, and they put each kind of chapter as basically the extended version of that commandment. So, it's a great way to look at these laws. Chapter 12 is the extended version of honor God first, okay? Have no other gods before me, all right? So that's the idea. Look real quick at chapter 17, and I want you to notice something that's coming that God predicts. This is important, okay? Chapter 17, verse 14. God gives them a peek into the future, okay? Read 17, 14 for me. What is, all right, so what is God talking about here?
He's predicting that Israel is going to want to have a king.
Yeah, he's going to tell them, hey, you're going to get in the land, and one day you're going to want a king. Now, how does God feel about them having a king? Do they need a king? A physical king? No. Who's their king? God, right? Why would they want a king then? Everybody else has a king. We need a king. Everybody else has a Fabio, big, strong, tough guy with 18-inch biceps and long flowing hair, goes and fights battles for us. We want one of those guys, okay? I.e., the first guy they picked for the king, that's exactly what he looks like, okay? Ladies, you would swoon when Saul walked in the room. He was a big, strong, handsome, battle-toughened dude from Benjamin that could wield a sword, and he was really, really impressive on the outside. Problem was, God didn't pick him. So the guy that God did pick was David, and none of you would have turned your head at all when he walked into the room. He's unimpressive, red-headed kid with freckles and green eyes, and you would have went, really? And he plays a harp. Okay, like you're an artist. But God said, that's the guy I want for the king, okay? So interesting, God knows, hey, your hearts are going to turn because you're going to see what everyone else has. I don't want you to be influenced by the nations. I want you to influence them, but what's going to happen? They're going to see that and go, that's what we need. So God says, okay, we'll compromise. Okay, you're going to want a king, but verse 15, here's the type of king that you get.
You may indeed set a king over you whom the Lord your God will choose. One from among your brothers you shall set as king over you. You may not put a foreigner over you who is not your brother.
All right, so give me some rules for who this king can be. Chosen by God, okay? First rule, God gets to pick. Okay, that's good. I told my daughter she can get married, I just get to choose her husband. No problem with that, right? And when she was fine, I made her sign a contract, and I still have it in my office today, and I remind her of it all the time. Oh, yeah. Signed by witnesses. I said, you shouldn't have signed it if that's not what she meant. So it's really funny. So now that she's in sixth grade, she doesn't find it near as funny. I find it hilarious, but yes. All right, so God gets to choose, all right? Where can the king come from?
An Israelite.
What does that mean? They're an Israelite, right? So can you have a foreigner? No. Does the king have to be from Judah? No. All right. Benjamin was the first tribe that had a king. Saul, David's from Judah. And then they're going to be from various different places after that. Okay. So has to be from Israel. No foreigner. Okay. What else? Keep going in 16. Here's, they're going to get 16, 17, and 18 or give them, 16 and 17 or give them three rules is what the king can and can't do.
Only he must not acquire many horses for himself or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses. Since the Lord has said to you, you shall never return that way again.
All right, so rule one, can't do what? Can't go back to Egypt for what specifically?
Horses.
Why horses? Like why would that? Why would the acquiring of horses be on the list for a king? That's the first thing God says. Okay, partly. It's also a sign of wealth and importance. I've got a lot of horses. I've got a stable full of, you know, so it was a picture of excess, okay? So no excess in there, okay? You can have a Honda Civic and you can have an SUV. You don't need a Lamborghini and a this and a, all right, you get what cars that you need and be content with them. So that's what he's saying, okay? Don't flaunt the fact that you have stuff, okay? Keep going in 17.
And he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold.
Okay, so first part of 17, what can he have? Many wives, okay? So why would a king want to have many wives? What would be the an heir to the throne, okay, potentially. So if he can't have a kid, that's one reason. Okay, it was a political move, okay? If the king of Egypt has a daughter and I wed her, it's a peace treaty. Okay, but what is that daughter bringing with her into Israel? The gods that you worship and your lifestyle and this, that, and the other thing. Well, then I also married a woman from Assyria who brings in her gods and her lifestyle. Now what's Solomon worried about? Can you imagine dealing with multiple women? And it's a nightmare, right? So he's got to deal with the gods they bring in, from their personalities and all the stuff that comes with that. So he's basically telling them, hey, look, marry a woman, love her, and don't bring in all this, don't play the political game, okay? So you're not going to go that way, right? And you brought up Solomon. How many wives and concubines does it say that he had in Scripture?
1,000.
It's like 900. 900 wives and concubines. We were in a study one time, and our pastor mentioned, he said, yeah, I read that verse, and he said, he mentioned that's enough for Solomon to have a different wife every day for 3 years. And one of the college students says, or three wives a day for a year. Stupid fraternity guy. Like, idiot. Like, only a guy, right? Generally speaking, the reason that you would take multiple wives was not for the, it wasn't for sex. It was for political alliances and to set yourself up. So he's basically saying, king, you need to trust God and don't enter into treaties like that, okay? Or at least not multiple ones. There was room, again, as we see in the scriptures, for you taking on your brother's wife and your brother died and you take care of them. So that was green light, okay? You'll notice 17, whenever we see multiple wives, what always is on the heels of that. Don't take multiple wives because your heart will turn away from me, okay? And that's what God's saying, okay? So always when we see it, it's interesting. That's what God's reason is. They will lead you astray to worship other gods, okay? Last thing, what else? And silver and gold, okay? You can't have excess money, okay? So thinking about Solomon, how do you do there? Fail, 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 right? It's like, oh boy, right? So, okay. What I want you guys to see is God's predicted this. He doesn't want it. He knows they're going to do it. So he says, listen, this is your choice, okay? I know you're going to do it. Here are the confines of which you need to choose. You're not going to be able to basically stand up to the people in the nation, and you're going to give in. So pick this type of king, okay? Now, last thing, verse 19. 18 and 19. Read that. This is his job.
And when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself in a book a copy of this law, approved by the Levitical priests. And it shall be with him, and he shall read in it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by keeping all the words of this law and these statutes.
Okay. So what's his job? Read what? The Bible, right? Have a Bible and read it. Like, wouldn't you love to be able to tell, like, our political leaders that? Here's a Bible, just read it and do some things that it says. You don't have to do all of them, just some, right? So be godly, read the law, know what it says, obey it, okay? Have it with you. So, and make sure it's an approved Bible from the Levitical priest. It's not something that you made up for your own selfish whatever, okay? So that's the idea. So if a king's coming, which it is, okay, no excess horses, no excess wives, no excess money, read your Bible, okay? Simple as that, okay? Most of our kings are going to fail miserably in most or all of those things, okay? So there you are, all right? So again, more laws all throughout here, okay? We've read all of this stuff. This is, again, all of this is a review all the way up until chapter 28. Now we're getting into this covenant language, okay? So, you guys remember we read earlier on, okay? What happens if you obey the law? Bless you. You get blessings, and if you disobey, it's curses. Look at chapter 28, okay? Verses 1 through 14 are the blessings if you obey the law, okay? This is the formalization of the covenant that they made. The covenant they made with the old generation. This is the new generation. 1 through 14, here are the blessings that come. 15 all the way to the end of chapter 28. Mine goes to 68. Yours should too. Okay? Those are the cursings. Okay? 14 verses on positive, 60 all the way to 68 on negative. Okay? So that's a lot of negative, all right? So you guys can glance through that, but the idea is, look, life's going to be wonderful if you'll obey me. Life's going to be miserable if you don't, and the reason I'm going to make it miserable is to turn your hearts back towards me, okay? That's 28, all right? Make sense? And it's some strong things. God even tells them, look at 28 verse 36. God says, if you continue to disobey, ultimately, this is what I'm going to do, 36.
The Lord will bring you and your king, whom
shall serve other gods of wood.
What does that mean? The Lord will bring you and your king, the guy that you've chosen, to a nation which your fathers have not known. What is that speaking of?
Talking about Babylon.
Yeah. I'm going to take you out with your king into a nation, and they're going to oppress you. Okay? We're going to see more of that. Okay? As we see the captivity that's coming in Babylon and Assyria, God predicts this multiple times in this book. Okay? With great clarity. All right? So that's 28. All right? 29, this is the Palestinian covenant. Okay? You guys remember way back when, like years ago when we studied Genesis, and we talked about the Abrahamic covenant. What were the three aspects? Land, seed, blessing. Okay? The land portion, okay, each one of those covenants we talked about is reiterated in greater detail in the scriptures. The first one now that we're seeing reiterated is this one. The land portion is called the Palestinian covenant, land of Palestine. 29 and 30 are the boundaries of the land, what's going to happen to some of this stuff. Okay, not so much just the boundaries, but the land and what God's going to do with it. Okay, so this is important. So chapters 29 and 30 are the Palestinian covenant dealing with the land. Okay, the land of Palestine. Okay, bless you. All right, let's just take a look at this. I want you guys to see kind of what's going on in here. Okay, 29 is a reminder to them. Okay, somebody pick up in verse 2. All right, and you're seeing this reiterated, okay? You've had plenty of bread, wine to drink, and he walks them through all that they've done. Verse 10, you stand here today, all of you, before the Lord your God, your chiefs, your tribes, your elders, your officers, all the men of Israel, your little ones, the aliens, everyone that brought with you. Verse 13, in order that he may establish you and his people, and that he may be your God. So now they're formalizing kind of this idea of this covenant with them, okay? So, some of you, verse 15, your hearts are not with us here today. He's saying some of you are going to turn away. That's going to happen. Verse 18, so that there will not be among you a man or a woman or family, a tribe whose heart turns away today from the Lord our God to go and serve gods, these other nations, that there would not be among us a root bearing poisonous fruit. Don't let there even be a seed of discontent, a seed of disobedience. Okay, and he's talking to them about what they're about to do and enter this land. Okay. Chapter 30 is kind of even more detailed explanation of that, all right? Real quick, look at verse 27 of chapter 29. Read 27 and 28.
Therefore, the anger of the Lord was kindled against this land, bringing upon it all the curses written in this book. And the Lord uprooted them from their land in anger and fury and great wrath, and cast them into another land.
Okay, so what is that speaking of? This is future. What is God predicting yet again? Yeah, this is Israel's disobedience in the exile. So he's like, before they even walk into the land, he's already saying, I'm going to kick all of you out. So, because I know you're going to disobey. Okay, and this is chapter 30 is a even greater picture of that. Okay, 30 verse 1. These things have come upon you, the blessings and the curses which I have set before you, and you call them to mind in the nations where the Lord your God has banished you. So you're going to come in, I'm going to kick you out because of disobedience. When some of you finally get your head screwed on straight and realize, boy, we've messed up, we need to get our hearts right. When these things come to mind, after God has banished you, in verse 2, you return to the Lord your God and obey him with all of your heart and your soul according to all that I've commanded you today. Verse 3, watch what's going to happen. Keep going there.
Then the Lord your God will restore your fortunes and have compassion on you, and he will gather you again from all the peoples where the Lord your God has scattered you. If your outcasts are in the uttermost parts of heaven, from there the Lord your God will gather you. And from there, he will take you.
So what is God promising to them? Regardless of how far you're spread out, because I'm going to kick you out of the land, regardless of how disobedient you are, if you're in Assyria or Babylon or Persia or wherever, I will grant you permission to come back in the land, okay? It's fascinating. This is, they're on the Jordan River getting ready to go into the land for the very first time, and God predicts all of this, okay? Verse 1 and 2 are quoted back to God by a guy who went through this exact same thing. Anybody know who quoted that back to God? Was kicked out of the land, realized, whoo, the reason that we're here is because of disobedience. We need to go back into the land. In fact, God promised us if we repent, God will let us back in. Nehemiah, okay? When God called him to go back into the land, that's where this started. He's living in Susa, the Persia capital, okay? Assyria comes in first. Babylon takes over them, okay? Takes the southern portion of Israel captive. So Assyria, then Babylon. Persia then becomes world conqueror, and Cyrus, king of Persia, says, man, you've got some freedom with me. So he asks him permission to go, and God uses that king in Artaxerxes to let these guys go back. And when Nehemiah is serving underneath Artaxerxes, he's reading his Bible one day and goes, huh, God said we could go back. We just need to repent first. And he does, and he quotes it back to God and says, God, you promised this? And God said, yep, you're right. Repent, get the people to repent, and you can go home. Okay, so Nehemiah takes this hundreds of years later and says, God, this must be true. Okay, so pretty cool. Okay, so verse 5 and following, I'll bring you to the land. I will multiply you. verse 6, the Lord will circumcise your heart and the heart of your descendants to love the God with God with all your heart and all your soul in order that you may live. Okay, verse 6, this idea of circumcision of heart. Right now, they have a law, a physical law, 10 of which are written on tablets and the other which are written on whatever they wrote them on, to obey God, 634 of them. God says, one day, you're not going to need a law. I'm going to do something different with you. I'm going to make a new covenant, and I'm going to put that covenant on your heart, okay? Anybody know the name of that covenant? It's in the book of Jeremiah. It's called the New Covenant, okay? And it talks about the Spirit of God coming and sealing them, okay? So that's coming as well. The blessing portion, land, seed, blessing, the blessing portion is the covenant in the book of Jeremiah, okay, 33 or 34. So we'll get to that, okay? So interesting that that's predicted, all right? So just want you guys to see this. God is calling the shots way from the beginning, okay, that all this is coming, all right? You with me? Fabulous. All right.
They're hearing that they're going to disobey before they go in.
Yep. And God promises. Disobey. Yeah, and still disobey, and God promises to love them regardless. Isn't that fascinating? So God doesn't have these false expectations that, man, okay, that generation died off. They're all, we're good, right? You guys are going to obey, and it's going to be fantastic. God says, no, you're people. You're going to turn. I know what's going to happen, and I love you regardless. That's what's amazing about this. In fact, he's going to whisper in Moses' ear the details of that in a chapter. It's insane. I mean, like, they're going to do all of that, and you're still going to let them go in? Are you crazy? So, but that's the beauty of God, right? Okay? So, this was what's cool too. Look at chapter 30, verse 11. And I want you to notice how God views their relationship with him and the law. This is what he tells the people.
This commandment that I command you today is not too hard for you, neither is it far off. It is not in heaven that you should say, who will ascend to heaven for us and bring it to us that we may hear it and do it. Neither is it beyond the sea that you should say, who will go over the sea for us?
He's saying to them, this, guys, this stuff isn't that hard, right? It's not in heaven that you have to be some giant to reach up and get it or the depths of the sea to figure it out. It's not. It's here. It's among you. It's in your mouth. It's this is the law. Just, you can do this, okay? So it's not that it was, the task was terribly impossible. It's that they had a sin nature to deal with, like all of us, that tends to not want to do the things that God wants us to do, right? So that's his call to them, all right? Now, 31, now we're going to see the final portion of Moses' life, okay? So 31:1, let's pick up there.
So Moses continued to speak these words to all Israel, and he said to them, I am 120 years old today. I am no longer able to go out and come in. The Lord has said to me, you shall not go over this Jordan.
All right, remember we broke down Moses' life, 40, 40, 40. Okay, so this is the last third of his life. He's 120. He's getting ready to die. Okay, he's older. Now we're going to find out that he still had some go left in him. God's going to take him, okay? But he's older, okay? And he's getting to the end of his life, and he's not quite the guy that he used to be, okay? So keep reading there, Jared.
The Lord your God himself will go over before you. He will destroy these nations before you, so that you shall dispose them. And Joshua will go over at your head, as the Lord has spoken.
So he reminds them, hey, God's going to go first. He's going to destroy these nations. Joshua is your guy. Okay, don't forget that. God is going to do his job. You do yours. Look at verse 6, verse 7, verse 8. Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid or tremble before them. Verse 7, be strong and courageous. Verse 8, do not fear or be dismayed. Why would Moses have to tell them that three times in a row? Because he's leaving, and how do they feel? Strong and courageous? No, they feel weak and fearful and utterly useless right now, okay? How do you think Joshua feels as a leader? The exact same. In fact, God's going to pull Joshua aside and tell him the same thing. Be strong and courageous, Joshua. I know you're scared. You know you're going up against seven nations that are bigger and stronger than tougher. It's not about you. It's about me. And God's going to call him to do something nuts when he goes into the land. It doesn't make any sense, okay? But it shows his trust in God, okay? So Moses realizes, look, you guys are freaking out. We've been living in the desert for 40 years, eating manna, no battles. It's been hard, but this is a whole different type of hard, and we're not used to this. And we got to go to battle, and we're not a battle-worn, ready people. So just trust God, be strong and courageous. Don't freak out, okay? So that's basically his message to them in a nutshell, okay? He reminds them in verse 10, Moses does, that the law of God and obedience is going to be really important, okay? At the end of every 7 years, you're going to celebrate the remission of debts at the Feast of Booths. Verse 11, when all of Israel comes to appear before the Lord at the place that he will choose, you shall read this law in front of all of Israel and in their hearing. Assemble the people, the men, the wilderness, the children, the aliens, in order that they may hear and learn and fear the Lord our God. So he's like, listen, be intentional. Pick up the Bible and read it publicly in front of everybody and listen and learn and make that a normal practice in Israel, okay? Very doubtful that they did that, right? So that is his heart, and he reminds them of what's going to happen, okay? So verse 15, look at this. The Lord appeared in the tent in the pillar of the cloud, and he says to Moses in verse 16, here's God's knowledge of what's about to come. That, like, the covenant that we just got finished making in 29 and 30, they're going to do all of this, okay? Right. You're like, oh, that's awful. And this isn't like, hey, they're going to multiply horses. This is no. They're going to go, Evan's version says, whore after other gods. Like, they are going to do the worst of the worst sins. They're going to embrace other gods, worship other gods, abandon me. They're going to hurt me at the deepest place. And yet I'm still going to love them. They're going to break my covenant. I'm going to bring them back in the land anyway. I'm going to have to throw them out because they're going to be so disobedient. He says in 17, my anger will be kindled against them that day. I will forsake them and hide my face from them. And they shall be consumed, and many evils and trouble shall come upon them. And they will say, is it not because our God is not among us that these evils have come to us? God's going to say, that's what you want to do? I will take my hands off the steering wheel. Go worship other gods, Assyria, Babylon. Come on in. You got a green light. Destroy that nation. Take him into captivity. Come be squatters in the land. You can have it. Okay? So that's God's heart with that. You're going to see something interesting in God too. His love is not just for the people. His love is actually for the land as well. God has such an attachment to that geographical piece of land that he says, I will not allow my people to dishonor me in that area. I will kick them out. I would rather pagan nations come in and worship pagan gods, then my people be in there and not worship me because I love that land, okay? So knowing that we're going to go there, it's just an interesting, there it is again, view that God has, okay? He likes the land, okay? He loves the people, but he also loves that portion of land because it's his, okay? So he tells Moses, they're going to disobey. I'm going to have to throw them out, okay? So Moses, he tells Moses in 19, Here's what's going to help, okay? 19, here's what you want to teach them. Read that.
Now, therefore, write this song and teach it to the people of Israel. Put it in their mouth that the song may be a witness for me against the people of Israel.
Okay, chapter 32 is the song, okay? It's called the Song of Moses, and he's going to teach them a song, basically to sing, that when they get discouraged, they would remember God and cling to him. Okay, so he says they're going to do these things, so give them something that they can cling to in the midst of it. Okay, that's the idea. All right, so 32, let's just look through it. This is the Song of Moses. All right, 32:1, somebody pick up there.
Give ear, O heavens, and I will speak, and let the earth hear the words of my mouth.
So two witnesses, heaven and earth, to this song. Okay, and this is 2 and 3 are going to describe Moses' teaching. This is pretty cool. Read that.
May my teaching drop as the rain, my speech distill as the dew, like gentle rain upon the tender grass, and like showers upon the earth. For I will proclaim the name of the Lord, ascribe greatness to our God.
Okay, this is a great, for those of you guys that have desires to sit in pulpits one day or to teach other people, this is a great reminder of what teaching should do. Let my teaching drop as the rain, my speech distill as the dew, as droplets on the fresh grass and showers on the herb. What picture do you hear when you, or do you see when you hear that? It's refreshing, right? Moses is hoping that what he has done for this people has been a source of refreshment for them, that what came out of his mouth as a leader was good, was honoring, was refreshing, was a buoy to the people in the midst of distress. Okay, so good reminder for all of us that are going to influence anybody with our words. This is what we should be for people, okay? And Moses is saying, Lord, I hope I was that, okay? He goes on to say the rock in verse 4, his work is perfect, and he admonishes God, a God who is a faithfulness without injustice and righteousness, the character of God. Even though verse 5, they're jacked and they disobey, God still loves them. So he reminds them again of the character of God, all right? Now he's going to begin in verse 7 and following to walk through in Old Testament history. Okay, so let's just read a little bit and see if you can pick out where Moses is going. Okay, and we've seen, again, every patriarch that's died has done this. Moses is going to do it as well. Okay, pick up in verse 8.
When the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, when he divided mankind, he fixed the borders of the peoples according to the number of the sons of God.
Okay, when was that? When was the first time Israel stepped foot in the land? Under what guy?
Abraham.
Okay, so he brings in Abraham. He separated the sons of man. That's probably a reference to the Tower of Babel with the languages and the separation literally of languages that day. According to the number of the sons of Israel, for the Lord, the Lord's portion is of his people. Jacob is his allotment and inheritance. Okay, when did we see Jacob elevated and his sons elevated? It's for the end of the book of Genesis, right? So you kind of see him just working through this deal, okay? Verse 10, keep going.
He found him in a desert land and in the howling waste of the wilderness. He encircled him, he cared for him, he kept him as the apple of his eye.
Okay, when was Jacob in a desert place in a wilderness, or the sons of Jacob rather, and God cared for them? Should sound vaguely familiar. That's what we just read, right? That's where they've been in Numbers. God says, I found you there and I took care of you, okay? I encircled you, okay? In the howling waste of a wilderness, okay? Fascinating language that we're going to pick up in Israel some more. You guys remember Brad talked about Midbar, Siyah, and Yeshimon? This word here is the Yeshimon, the howling waste of a wilderness, and it's actually Tohu Yeshimon. It means like complete, utter nothingness. Okay, at the beginning when God created the heavens and the world, and he says it is, what are the words that he uses? Formless, void. That word void is the same word that's used there. It's like there was nothing and it was chaos, and that's where Israel was, and God said, I took care of you in the midst of, you can't paint a harder situation, and yet I put you there and I took care of you in the midst of it. Okay, so verse 11, how does he do that? Read this. Now, I'm not, you guys can look on Snoops, I'm not sure if this is true or not, but I've heard the way an eagle teaches a baby eagle how to fly is it takes her wing and shoves baby eagle out of the nest and then watches it go. And then catches it on the way down. So you're going to learn to fly right now, okay? So what better way to learn? Okay, you get shoved out of the nest. God puts you in a difficult spot, but what does he say? I hovered over my young. He spread his wings and caught them, okay? So that's it. God said, look, this isn't lecture. This is lab. You get to figure it out, okay? I love you, but I'm going to put you in difficulty so that you will learn, okay? So that's the idea with God, okay? So again, walking through how he took care of them. Look at verse 13. He made him ride on the high places of the earth, and he ate the produce of the field. He made them suck honey from a rock and oil from flinty rock. When did God bring water from a rock? Remember that? Book of Numbers, okay? You see where we're at? Verse 14, curds of cows and milk and flock with lambs and rams in the Bashan and goats and the finest of wheat and the blood of grapes you drank. Okay, that's what's coming. They're about to walk into the land and it's going to be abundance. Okay, so they're going to go from manna, which they hated, into eating a whole bunch of stuff that they didn't plant, they didn't work for, and it's abundance. Okay, so all this stuff, the finest of wheat and all these blessings. Okay, but verse 15. Who is Jeshurun? You remember? That's God's pet name for Israel, right? My little Jeshurun. It means upright one. Okay, Jeshurun grew fat and kicked. What's the condition of Israel when they've been in the land for a while? What does it mean that they've grown fat? Lazy. They eat and are content, and they're at the opposite end of the spectrum. Before they had suffering to the nth degree, now they've got success, and they don't know how to handle either one of them. So they abandoned God. They don't need God. Okay, they forsook God and scorned the rock of their salvation. End of verse 15. They made him jealous with strange gods. With abominations, they provoked him to anger. They sacrificed to demons who are not God, to gods whom they have not known. This is what's coming in the chapters that are ahead of us. This is what Israel does in the land. Okay, so God says, great, you want to do that? Fine. Verse 18, you neglected the rock who begot you. You forgot the God who gave you birth. The Lord saw this in verse 18, spurned them. And because of the provocation of his sons and daughters, he said to them, I will hide my face from them. I will see what their end will be, for they are a perverse generation, sons in whom there is no faithfulness. Okay, this is a great verse right here, 21. Read this. By the way, what are we talking about here when God says, I'm going to hide my face from them? What period of time is that? Exile, okay? You want to do that? Fantastic. Israel, Assyria, or Babylon, come on in, okay? 21, see if this sounds familiar.
They have made me jealous with what is no God, so they have provoked me to anger with their idols. So I will make them jealous with those who are no people. I will provoke them to anger with the foolish nation.
Okay, now that's quoted in the New Testament. Anybody got a note as to where that's quoted? Side note on there, a cross-reference? Romans chapter 10, okay? That is the death valley of Scripture, 9, 10, and 11 of Romans. You guys will get there, okay? Quoted by Paul. What does it mean? What is Paul talking about in Romans, or what is Moses talking about here? You made me jealous by what is not a God. I will make you, Israel, jealous by what is not a people. What is that? Gentiles. Specifically what? What action with the Gentiles is God speaking of? What is he doing with the Gentiles in Romans chapter 10? Salvation. You don't want me? Fine. I will give my spirit, and I will allow people who don't know me, who are not even a people that I've set my heart on and love, to come to Christ, to make you jealous, because you made me jealous by what is not a God.
Did Jesus have a story that he...
Yeah, it's the picture. It's the wedding feast. That's what it's the same picture. Okay, you don't want to come? Fine, I will invite other people that want me, or I will incline them to want me. So, just a cool picture, right? So, where are we now, history-wise? Where's Moses? This is New Testament. He's painting what's going to happen. Okay, so I mean, this again, fascinating that God lets them do that. Okay. So there's going to be a time when Gentiles are going to come to God freely that God will invite in, okay? Because of Israel's disobedience, okay? Guys, remember that, okay? The reason that we have faith is because of Israel's disobedience. Without them rejecting God, we don't get God, okay? So we have a huge debt owed to them and a huge love for them that they would turn and come back, okay? Because we are we're a comma in the Bible. That's where we show up. This is Israel's God that we get to worship, okay? So our heart for them should be very much inclined to see them return to the God that brought them out of the wilderness and all of these things, okay? So 22 and following, just again, same idea of God's frustration with them and so on and so forth, okay? And he's going to go on even into what looks like 23 and following is end times and destruction, and God's painting like even pictures of Revelation and all that's going to occur, okay? So 28 and following, all the way up to, if you look at 34, he's talking about the people that don't know God. One of the most famous American sermons that's ever been preached by Jonathan Edwards, Sinners in the Hand of an Angry God. It comes from this text in Deuteronomy, okay? So you got to be a pretty good preacher when you can preach Deuteronomy and people freak out, okay? So probably the only time they ever heard it, okay? This was the theme. Look at verse 34. This is the theme of his sermon. Jonathan Edwards was speaking to people that have hardened their heart towards God, okay? Read that.
Lord will vindicate his people and have compassion on his servants. When he sees that their power is gone and there is none remaining, bond or free.
Okay, so he's telling folks that think, man, life's good, everything's fine. He says, you have this arrogant attitude of life. You've rejected God. You think everything's fine, but in due time, your foot will slip. The false reality that you think you live in, where there's no judgment and nothing's coming and all's good, That's gonna turn, and God says in verse 34, is not vengeance mine? I have the right to enact that. And it said when Jonathan Edwards used to preach this, literally, he would preach it in like almost a monotone voice, and people would pass out in the aisles, like out of just the fear and horror of not submitting to a God who promises to bring judgment. And just because he's allowed you to live in a season of prosperity doesn't mean that you get a free pass, okay? So anyway, that's again, end time stuff that Moses was predicting, all right? So that's the idea. 32 is this song. Guys, remember this, Israel, okay? You're going to want to turn away from God, sing this song, okay? Long song, okay? Don't know what the lyrics were. We didn't get those, but that's the idea, all right? So in 46 and following, if you want to look at Moses' view on God and the law, here you go. Here's the Cliff Notes version, 46. 32:46.
He said to them, take to heart all the words which I am warning you today, that you may command them to your children, that they may be careful to do all the words of this law. For it is no empty word for you, but your very life, and by this word we shall live long in the land that you are going to, that you are going over.
Okay, 47, it says, for it is not an idle word for you, indeed it is your life. Israel, this is your life. This is the theme and the centermost point of who you are. These words that you're hearing today, don't take these lightly. This isn't some aside. Your life is enveloped in these things. So Moses sees these things and says, this is what my life's work is about. Obey God and walk with God, all right? So that's the idea. All right, now 33, after we get a prophecy, what usually comes next when someone's about to die? Let's talk to all the kids, right? Let's give them blessings. Here's what's going to come. And as you look through 33, that's exactly what it is, okay? Verse 5 of chapter 33, Jeshurun is mentioned again, so the people of Israel. Okay, the tribes are gathered together. Verse 6 is the first guy that's mentioned. Reuben, okay, why? Who's Reuben? Firstborn, okay? So he gets a very small blessing, better than he's gotten in the past, okay? So last time we heard Reuben's name spoken, it was about going up to a couch and sleeping with his father's concubine, okay? So this is better. May he live and not die, nor his men be few. Okay, so short but positive. Okay, Judah's next. Okay, he is the leader. Okay, so we're going to see verse 7 is on him. 8 is about Levi. Okay, let your Thummim and your Urim. Those are the things that the tribe of Levi would have used to, like dice, to predict the future and the will of God. He says, you're going to have those. Okay, so they get a pretty long section of blessing and all that is coming with them. Verse 10, look at this. This is a description of what Levi is called to be. Read verse 10.
They shall teach Jacob your rules and Israel your law. They shall put incense before you and whole burnt offerings on your altars.
All right, so their job is to teach the law of God and to intercede before you. Okay, so very, again, important job. You're going to intercede and you're going to teach the people godliness. You teach them how to walk with me. Okay, Benjamin, verse 12. Okay, he gets a blessing. And then 13 all the way through 17. Notice who that's about. Joseph, right? Reuben and Manasseh, his two kids. These are the guys that are getting the lion's share of the blessing. Again, he gets the lion's share of the text. So 13 through 17, all about him. And then you just see, you know, a couple other ones mentioned. Okay, 18, Zebulun. 20 is Gad. 22, Dan. Short, but he's still there. Okay, remember, Dan's going to, like, mysteriously just exit stage left at some point. We don't know what happened, okay? But God's going to give them land, and they're going to decide to relocate. They don't like the land God gave them. And we'll talk about that when we get to Israel, okay? And then as we get into the book of Revelation and following, and God reiterates all the tribes, Dan is like, where'd you go, dude? Just gone, okay? So they were marked by disobedience, okay? And yeah, more about them as we get into the book of Kings, but they have a very interesting role to play in history, okay? And not a good one at that, okay? 23, Naphtali, Asher, you guys can see all those, okay? So they're all in there, all right? So that's the blessing that he hands on, okay? So he's prophesied, he's blessed, 34, now he's going to die, okay? So this is the last chapter of the book of Deuteronomy. Now we're going to see Moses put to bed, okay? 34:1, let's pick up there.
Then Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo, to the top of
Pisgah,
which is opposite Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land, Gilead as far as Dan.
Okay, so he is on east side of the Jordan. He's not in the land. He's standing on top of probably the most significant mountain chain there, the highest at least, on the top of Moab. Those are the mountains to the west, to the east of the Jordan River. And God shows him the entire land from Gilead as far as Dan. So he gets a tour. Moses, here you go. Here's the land. Joshua was about to lead the people into it. So he gets to see all of it, okay? Naphtali, land of Ephraim, Manasseh, into the land as far as Judah is to the western sea, okay? So he gets a bird's eye view of everything, okay? Verse 4 now, keep going there.
And the Lord said to him, this is the land of which I swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. I will give it to your offspring. I have let you see it with your eyes, but you shall not go over there.
So again, sad note, God says, man, I'm sorry, you don't get to go in, okay? Rewind the tapes. How long has it been since God made that promise to Abraham? We're like 400, 500 years. Exodus was 1446. They've been in the wilderness. We're like 1400 BC right now. So, I mean, God's saying, I made that promise 400 and however many years ago and how many generations ago, I still remember that. The United States isn't even 400 years old, right? And God is, it's like God saying, I made that promise to George Washington, and it's going to get fulfilled in, like, you know, 2200, right? It's amazing that God would be that concerned about something that's that old. We forget, like, how old that is. Like, they don't know who that person, who's Abraham, right? They didn't know him. They've just heard rumors, right? And that's kind of, right? We don't know George Washington. We know he lived. We know he was real. We heard the stories. But it's just, that's God's covenant promise, and that's how serious he takes it, okay? Verse 5, keep going.
So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord, and he buried him in the valley in the land of Moab, opposite Beth Peor. But no one knows the place of his burial to this day.
How crazy is that? What does that mean? What just happened? God buries Moses, right? That's not said of anybody in Scripture. God He puts him to death on top of this mountain, buries him, and to this day, nobody knows where that is. Like, I mean, that's, you talk about an intimacy with God that few others ever enjoyed. That's special, okay? So God buries him. And again, I think Brad made a great note of it. What would the people do if they had a big monument that said, Moses? We would bow down and worship it, right? We would reject John, whatever. They would be tempted to do all kinds of wacko things with it. So God said, I'll just bury him. Oh, we'll take care of this, okay? So God buries him. Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eyes were not dim, nor his vigor abated. What does that mean? He's old, but he ain't that old. He still had, you know, time left. And God said, no, your job's done. You're coming home. And now it's Joshua's turn. Okay, so he still had some life left in him. Okay. Verse 8, the sons of Israel wept now for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days. Okay, so they weep now for Moses and his death. They stay there before they go in, and they mourn appropriately the life of Moses. Okay, 9, look who steps out. Read that.
And Joshua the son of Nun was full of the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands on him. So the people of Israel obeyed him and did as the Lord had commanded Moses.
All right, so we'll see how that goes. Are they going to obey Joshua? Are they going to listen to him? Did Moses do a significant job of handing off leadership enough to where these people are going to believe him now that Moses is gone? Okay, so read verse 10 and following, and keep going.
And there has not arisen a prophet since the Israelite Moses, whom the Lord who takes his faith. None like him for all the times and the wonders that the Lord sent him to do in the land of Egypt, to Pharaoh and to all his servants, and to all his men, and for all the mighty power and all the great deeds of terror that Moses did in the sight of all the people.
And that's his legacy right there. Never has been and never will there be another person that had the relationship with God like Moses. Incredible, right? Now think from Joshua's lens. How bad do you not want to be him, right? How do you live up to that? I mean, that's impossible. So the best thing about Joshua is he doesn't try to be Moses. He tries to be Joshua. He's a completely different leader. Joshua is a bulldog, ears pinned back, ready to fight. Very different guy than Moses, okay? And the reason that he succeeds in the book of Joshua is because he's him and not Moses, okay? So, and that's what God needed, all right? It's obvious, but good reminder to all of us. We all have heroes that we like to emulate. Joshua would have been a miserable failure had he tried to be Moses. God didn't need Moses. God needed Joshua, and he's the first and only, okay, and the best at that, okay? So just be you, right? Okay. You guys ready to do some Joshua now? We just finished the Torah. There you go, okay? Now, Just as a side thought, okay, there it is, all right, minus some maps and table of contents in the front of mine. A Jew, in old school, like when Jesus grew up, in school they would memorize that. That's insane. Genesis through Deuteronomy put to memory. That is how much the Torah was valued in their culture. So when they say, this isn't idle words, this is indeed your life, then how about we put it to memory, right? I've memorized Bruce Springsteen songs from like 1982 that I have in my head for some reason, and I can't remember John 3:16 most days, right? But these people, that's what the law means to them. Put it on your heart. Let it be there. Put it as frontals on your foreheads and phylacteries and know this law, okay? So so when we talk about the law of God, these people don't just talk about believing in it. And that's one of the things when we get to Israel that is absolutely shameful. There are people that don't love God, that are very secular Jews, and they have got more Bible memorized than you and I have ever forgotten. It's embarrassing. And these people are like, I'm not even sure if I believe it, but yeah, what do you want me to quote to you? You know, that's just their life, okay? So, all right, Joshua, okay? Theme of Joshua is success, okay? For the most part, in Joshua, they do a great job. They are successful in doing what God called them to do. Okay, so success, all right? Chapters 1 through 5 are preparation, okay? A lot like Numbers. Chapters 1 through 10 of Numbers were preparation to move. Chapters 1 through 5 are preparation to conquer, okay? They're getting ready to go into the land to go do some business, all right? 6 through 12 is the actual conquest, okay? We are going to fight 31 battles in chapters 6 through 12, okay? Joshua's record, by the way, in battle is 31-0, and he gets one do-over called Ai, okay? They don't get beat in battle. Who do you think beats Israel? Who usually beats Israel? Israel. Sin, okay? Hence, Ai, okay? Or, Ai, okay? 31-0 in battle, and they goof one up, and God says, I'm going to give you a redo on that one, okay? And the issue at hand there is sin in the camp, and that's why they lose the battle, okay? 1-5 is preparation. Preparation to conquer, preparation to go into the land, okay? 6-12... conquest, okay? So those are all 31 battles, okay? 13-22, half the book, 13-22, the division of the land. What does that tell you about the importance of the division of the land? That's insane, right? We're going to read 13-22, and the whole thing is about so-and-so, you get this land, and your families go here. It's like, wow, right? If we were Americans, we would have written 23 chapters on battle, because that's awesome. And we would have written like a paragraph on, okay, Simeon, you go there. Judah, you go there. You go hang out by the Mediterranean. You're going up north. Done, right? God says, no. I'm writing like 10 chapters on this, okay? And then 23-24, the last chapter, are the parting words of Joshua, okay? So 1-5, preparation. 6-12, conquest. 13-22, division of the land, okay? 23-24, parting words of Joshua. Okay, there's your book. Okay, theme is success. Ready? Let's go. Chapter 1, verse 1. Pick up there.
After the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord said to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, Moses, my servant is dead. Now therefore arise, go over this Jordan, you and all this people, into the land that I am giving to you, to the people of Israel.
Now, we've asked this question every time we've seen a patriarch die, okay? And we always wonder, is God's promise going to continue when Abraham dies? Will it get passed on to Isaac? No, it does. How about that? Okay, God still remembers his promise even though it didn't get fulfilled in the guy that he gave it to. Same with Joshua. God says, go, get up, we're going, okay? My promise and my purpose in Israel is continuing, so Joshua, you're the guy, get after it, okay? So, Moses is dead, you're done mourning, it's time to get down to business, okay? So you're going to cross the Jordan, that is your job, and I am giving you the land of Israel. Excuse me, verse 3, keep going.
Every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I have given to you, just as I promised to Moses.
Okay, interesting thing that you'll just learn in Israel, one of the ways to claim land was to go walk on it, okay? So one of the ways, instead of like, drawing up plans and saying from this point to this point and measuring it all, that's not how they did it back then, okay? You go walk the land, you walk the circumference, and you go, that's mine, okay? So that's one of the ways you would claim land, which is one of the reasons why you would see the patriarchs walk, go to the north, to the south, then to the Negev, up to Hebron, and following, saying, all this is mine. And it's one of the ways of saying, I'm staking my claim in the land, okay? So God says, wherever your foot steps, that land is yours, okay? And he's told them the borders. He said, but that's how we're going to claim it, okay? Keep going, 4 and following.
From the wilderness and this Lebanon, as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites to the great sea toward the going down of the sun shall be your territory.
Okay, now that, some of those things, Lebanon, specifically the river Euphrates, that was land that was mentioned in Genesis chapter 15 to Abraham. That river specifically. All of it, Joshua, is yours. So again, these promises have been a long time coming, and it's there, okay? I got a note in my Bible, it's about 300,000 square miles, okay? And again, you've seen Israel on the maps stuck inside like the Central Valley and other places. It's not that big, okay? But the land is significant, okay? So that's the idea. All right, keep going to 5. All right, so before Joshua goes into the battle, what does God remind him of? Dude, I'm here. I am with you as I was with Moses, and you've seen my track record with him. It's been pretty good. I am with you, okay? I will not abandon you. I am not going to forsake you, so don't sweat it, okay? Verse 6 now and 7. Read both those.
Be strong and courageous, for you shall cause this people to inherit the land that I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous, being careful to do according to all the law that Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may have good success wherever you go.
Okay, 6, 7, be strong and courageous, be strong and courageous. Verse 9, be strong and courageous. Why does God have to keep telling Moses or Joshua, be strong and courageous? Because he's freaking out, right? And rightly so. This is a big job and it's scary, okay? So just remember that, okay? Joshua's not some guy that's immune to this. He feels exactly what we would feel in that situation, which is, Lord, are you sure that you picked the right guy, right? I'm scared to death. I don't want to do this, right? But there you go. Verse 8, we talked about the key to victory in Deuteronomy was what?
Obedience.
Obedience. Let's see if it's changed, verse 8. That was one of the first verses I ever put to memory, right? It's a great memory verse if you haven't already. God tells him, meditate on the law. This thing that we just got through reading, Joshua, know it. And when you know it, only then, after you've put it on your heart, will you find your way prosperous and will you have success, okay? God's rigged it that way, okay? So that's where he starts with him, all right? So verse 10, now Joshua's got to step up. God said, I'm with you. We're ready to go. You've got your marching assignments. Here we go.
And Joshua commanded the officers of the people, pass through the midst of the camp and command the people, prepare your positions for within 3 days. You are to pass over this Jordan and go and to take possession of the land that the Lord your God has given you.
All right, now this is interesting, okay? So God says, go do this, okay? Prepare for visions. He goes and talks to all the leaders, and he says, we're going over in 3 days, okay? Where did God tell him, wait 3 days? Do we see any of that? Does he give him battle plans? No, he just says, go attack the land, okay? I want you to notice something about Joshua, which I think is, it's important of all leaders, okay? Could they have waited 2 days? Yeah, could they have waited 4? Yeah, what does Joshua choose? 3. Why? No idea. I don't know that God told him. He just tells the people, this is how we're going to do it, okay? A leader's job isn't necessarily to be right. A leader's job is to be clear. So he tells the people, this is what we're doing. Were there other ways that they could have done it? More than likely, right? So, but Joshua says, this is my plan. God's told me to go climb the mountain. He didn't tell me how to climb it. This is how we're going to do it. So leaders, get ready. Pack your bags, we're going to the land, get your camelbacks ready to go, take 3 days to pack you a sack lunch and get ready to fight. We're gonna go, and this is how we're gonna do it. Are we clear? 3 days, let's go, okay? One of the great jobs of a leader is to bring clarity in the midst of chaos, right? He just draws a line in the sand and says, this is what we're gonna do, okay? And I appreciate that about him. He's not stymied by the fact that God didn't give him clear direction, okay? If God needed a guy that needed, you're going to do this, and you're going to do this, and then you're going to do this, and then, right, I'm going to wipe your nose for you. Like, that's not a leader, right? God says, go run up that mountain, okay? And a good leader goes, great, I don't need you to tell me how. I need you to tell me what my goal is, and I will get the people up that mountain, okay? And that's what God does with them. So, and Joshua's got that type of personality, and that's what he needed at that time, okay? Now, watch what else Joshua does. Brilliant. 12 and following.
Your God is providing you a place of rest and will give you this land.
Okay, so who's he talking to? Who are these people? Reuben, Gad, half tribe of Manasseh. You guys remember? The ones that wanted to settle on the other side of the land. And Moses said, okay, but when we go fight, you're coming with us. So who does Joshua go tap on the shoulder now? Hey guys, that promise that you made to Moses, I'm cashing that check right now, okay? You guys better be ready to fight. Okay, and we're going to find out real quick, were they serious? Because Moses is dead. They made the promise to him. Oh, yeah, we'll come fight, Moses. See ya. Right, you're not going to land. What do we care, right? Our land's conquered. We're good. We got sheep. We got goats. We got houses built. We're fine. We don't need to go in the land, okay? What are they going to do, okay? Keep reading 14 and see what Joshua calls them to.
All the men of valor among you shall pass over over arms before your brothers and keep and shall help them until the Lord gives rest to your brothers as he has to you, and they also take possession of the land that the Lord your God is giving them. Then you shall return to the land of your possession and shall possess it, the land that Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you beyond the Jordan toward the sunrise.
All right, so we're going to go fight. You're coming with, and you have permission to go home when we're done and not until, okay? Until God has given them possession, okay? 16, here's their answer.
And they answered Joshua, all that you have commanded us we will do, and wherever you send us we will go. Just as we obeyed Moses in all things, so we will obey you. Only may the Lord your God be with you as he was with Moses.
How's that sound? Yeah, we obeyed Moses, we're down, we're in, okay? So you see again, Moses did a great job of handing authority away from himself, putting it on Joshua and says, this is the guy. You obey him when I leave. And God affirmed that. And they said, great, we're in, okay? So they're gonna go to battle. Okay, we're gonna find out that they bring like 40,000 dudes ready to fight. So they've got a pretty big number of guys that they bring to battle, okay? So they're in, all right? Let's get through chapter 2 real quick. This is Rahab, okay? We've all heard this story in Sunday school, right? But this is now the first place that they're gonna go into the land, right? Chapter 2, rather. Let's pick up there.
And Joshua the son of Nun sent two men secretly from Shittim as spies, saying, go to the land, especially Jericho. And they went and came into the house of the prostitute, whose name was Rahab, and lodged there.
All right, so Joshua sends in two spies to go spy out the land, okay? What happened last time we saw spies go into the land? Yeah, chicken. It didn't work out so well, right? How many did he send before? 12. How many does Joshua send?
Two.
Probably learned a good lesson, right? The only two guys that came back with good news were me and Caleb. We only need two, so we're going to send two. So he sends two in, and who do they meet? Old Rahab, right? The prostitute, okay? Woman of the night, right? He was told the king of Jericho, saying, behold, men of the sons of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land. So king of Jericho gets word of it, okay? This is the first city that they're going to go attack is Jericho, okay? Three, keep going. All right, so she's in a tough spot, right? So she's basically, we know the story, taking these men. King finds out about it and says, bring them out to me. Okay, keep going.
But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. And she said, true, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from. And when the gate was about to be closed at dark, the men went out. I do not know where the men went. Pursue them quickly, for you will overtake them.
Okay, what do we call that? That's a lie, okay? So, and we're going to see very clearly that God honors this, okay? Because this is done out of faith, and we're going to see why here in just a second, okay? She brought them in, stuck them underneath the roof, okay? You guys will see in roofs in Israel or at that time of day, and we'll get to see some from Jesus' day. We're just made of big thatches of like straw or whatever that were placed on top of each other, okay? So like we have shingles that overlap. They would start on the bottom, lay thatch, lay another set over it, and work their way up to the top, and you could literally just peel back the roof. And there were pillars underneath it, but you could just peel it apart, right? And you would stick in whatever so that it was like waterproof when it rained. So literally, she just peeled the roof apart and put the roof back on top of them. So they're sitting underneath, you know, like straw, hiding from them up in the roof, okay? So she says, oh yeah, they're gone. They're outside the city. You better run fast because they've already left, right? So lies to this king and says, you need to go chase them, okay? Verse 8, before they lay down on the roof, she came up and said to them, verse 9, I know that the Lord has given you this land, and the terror of you has fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before you. So all these people that are in the land, what is their disposition towards Israel at this point? According to what she said in 9. They're freaking out, right? And we read this before or mentioned it. Okay, verse 10. Here are the two reasons. Here's what they have heard. Here are the rumors on the rumor mill.
For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt.
Okay, how long ago was that? 40 years ago. We heard about that, okay? And they've been mulling on that for 40 years. Dude, did you hear? Oh my God, right? That's what they're talking about. And more recently, what else? Okay, who are those chumps? Sihon and Og? Giants, okay? 13-foot-tall giants. So God parted the Red Sea, And God allowed you to whip a nation that was, they were unbeatable. So yes, our hearts are melting before you. So literally God's like, here it is on a silver platter. Just go to battle. These people are, you've already won the head game, right? You're in their head. So that's basically what he's saying, okay? So Rahab is, her heart stirred, not just in fear, but she's like, dude, your God is doing this. Our gods that we worship, they don't do this. And as a result, look at verse 11.
As soon as we heard it, our hearts melted, and there was no spirit left in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in the heavens above and on the earth beneath.
What does that sound like? Verse 11, from the mouth of a non-Christian. Yeah, your God, the Lord, your God, he is God in heaven and above and earth beneath. I mean, that's basically saying my gods that I've worshiped, they are meaningless. Your God is it. And I've been waiting for this day to confess with my mouth that I am a believer in that God, right? That is her conversion. Like she just confesses, I'm not an Israelite. In fact, I'm not even valued amongst my people. I'm a prostitute, but I believe in your God. Will God take a woman like that into his fold and say, absolutely, right? Verse 12, keep going.
Now then, please swear to me by the Lord that as I have dealt kindly with you, you also will deal kindly with my father's house. And give me a sure sign.
Okay, so she's asking for them to deal with her in a specific way. 12, see that word twice, kindly. Verse 14, the men promised to deal kindly with her. What would you guess that word is? Kindness, grace, unmerited favor. What's the word in Hebrew? You guys remember it? Hesed, okay? It's a word we've talked about before. That is the love of God put on people, okay? That unmerited favor or grace. That's what she's begging for. I don't deserve this. Please deal with me in a way that I know I don't deserve, okay? By the example of the testimony of my mouth, I am asking for what I know I do not merit on my own, okay? She's making a statement of faith. H-E-S-E-D. Hesed. That is the transliteration or whatever Andrew called it yesterday. Hebringlish or whatever, I forget. But yeah, so obviously we use different alphabets, so you transliterate into our language. So in our Hebrish. I like Hebringlish better, but whatever. He's the Hebrew scholar, so we'll go with Hebrish. Okay, so Hesed, H-E-S-E-D, all right? I would remember that word. 14, the men said to her, our life is yours if you do not tell this business of ours, and it shall come about when the Lord gives us the land that we will deal kindly with you. Okay, so we are basically saying, they're swearing by their own lives. If you deal kindly with us, don't give us up. When we come back in the land, we will spare you. Okay, and that's what she's asking for. I think that's just the person that they met. In the society, okay, the prostitutes, people lived in the wall around the city. She would have lived in the wall, so she was accessible outside. You know, if you're a prostitute and you see foreigners coming up, that would have been a very natural. So it would have been, I guess, normative for them to meet somebody like her. So no, I don't think there was anything shady going on behind the scenes that they would have run into her, okay? And obviously, you see from their response that there was no, like, they have very godly intentions, okay? And that's neat that they see this, right? They're protected by her and so on and so forth, okay? So they say, hey, you treat us right, you will be spared. Not just you, but you and your whole family, okay? She let them down, verse 15, by a rope in the window. And she says to them in verse 16, keep going. Okay, now think about this. You guys know the geography of Israel. They're in Jericho, okay? Jericho is down by the Jordan River, so it's in the wilderness, okay? She tells them to go to where? Hill country. Which way is that? Up and west, right? Continuing into the land. Why?
Because
the pursuers went out the gate to go get them towards the east. So she says, go into the hill country, hide there 3 days, stay there, and then when the coast is clear, come back out the other way. Okay, so smart plan, right? So she let them down, does this, tells them where to go. And then in 17, the men give her kind of a last command. So bring your whole family into your home in the wall, okay? And what are you going to show as a sign of your faith? Okay, so you're going to have to put a scarlet cord in the window so that when we come upon the land, we see it. And if it's not there, it's like the Passover. If the blood of the lamb is not over the door, the spirit is coming in and kids are going to die, okay? People are going to die. So you demonstrate your faith externally for all to see that you want to be saved in the midst of a pagan nation, okay? And we will spare your life. If you don't, the blood is not on our hands, okay? Our hands are clean to this matter, okay? So they basically agree to this, and they move on, okay? 22, read that. Okay, by the way, 22, how do you get from Jericho to the hill country? Like, there's not like 27 routes that you can take. You go through wadis, right? You guys remember the story of the Good Samaritan that was on his way from Jerusalem to Jericho? That's the route. There's only one way, okay? It's through a wadi, okay? And we, unfortunately, today can't pass that way because it's under Palestinian control. But back in like the 90s, Israel had the rights to do that, and some of the tour groups would go from Jericho and walk up to partway to Jerusalem, okay? But that's how they went, okay? Nasty place, right? In terms of, like, it's difficult terrain, difficult to travel, easy to hide, easy to get attacked and blindsided, okay? So that's the road that they would have taken, okay? So they're safe 3 days, and then keep going. Where'd you finish, 23? Yeah. So how's the report of the two spies that go out? Much better, right? God has given us this land and the people have melted before us. They are primed and ready to get spanked, right? Let's go in and let's defeat this people, okay? So chapter 3 we'll pick up on next week and we will see now the battles, all right? So be ready. We're going to hit them fast and furious and watch Israel take care of business, all right?